buttons you get, radio that turns you on.
Hi there, this is Ann Feeney, and you are listening to listener-supported community radio, KVU FM in Portland.
KVU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KVU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KVU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kvu.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kvu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland. From its founding, KBOO's purpose has been to serve as a community-driven alternative to mainstream media. In a new year, with numerous executive orders from a new presidential administration and the rise of misinformation, KBOO affirms its duty to serve its community. KVU, its programmers, volunteers, and staff do this by bringing you accurate information, by giving space to underrepresented voices, and by uplifting arts and culture. In these uncertain times, KVU seeks to be a guiding light for those who are scared, those who are affected, and those who are fighting the good fight. KVU stands with the immigrant community, the LGBTQIA+ community, the disability community, and all of those affected by the new administration. We stand here at 90.7 FM in Portland, 104.3 FM in the Corvallis-Philomath area, 91.9 FM in Hood River, and at KBOO.FM.
The following program is pre-recorded.
From Pacific Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, honoring our North Star and our friend, legendary Pentagon Papers whistleblower, Daniel Ellsberg, 1 year after his passing, will premiere the song North Star by Ada Bell, who composed it to honor the life and work of her family friend, hero, Daniel Ellsberg, as he lay dying. We'll also be joined for the hour by Dan's wife and life partner, Patricia, his son, Michael Ellsberg, and his longtime friend, poet, psychotherapist, Anita Barrows. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. But the investigation today is a celebration of Daniel Ellsberg. He's a good friend of this show. Sunday, June 16th, will mark 1 year since his death of since the death of Pentagon whistleblower, globally recognized peace activist, author, and yes, accomplished pianist, Daniel Ellsberg. In honor of Dan's life and work, Flashpoints on KPFA Pacifica has been given the privilege of premiering the final studio version of the original composition, North Star, by Ada Bell, a talented singer-songwriter who composed it to honor the life and work of her family friend, hero, Daniel Ellsberg, as he lay dying. Also on the show today, we will continue to remember Dan with his wife and loving partner for many years, Patricia, Dan's son, Michael, Dan's friend, poet, psychotherapist, Anita Barrows, and, of course, singer-songwriter, family friend, Edie Bell. So the story of the Pentagon Papers has been told widely and well. Ellsberg and a RAND colleague, Anthony Russo, had access to a copy of the 7,000 pages of classical documents and historical narrative on the war kept at the RAND Corporation. The pair photocopied them. Imagine this picture. Photocopied them at night, one page at a time over a period of months, and made them available to the press. Indeed, the release of the secret docs marked the beginning of the end of the Vietnam War. And as they say, the rest is history. But one side of Daniel's life history that people few people know about, is that his childhood was defined by intensive training to be a concert pianist, which was the focus of his life between ages 5 and 15 in Detroit. This part of his life is recounted in a personal essay he wrote, The Piano, which will be published next year by Bloomsbury Press in a book of his posthumous writing, edited by his son Michael and his longtime assistant, Jan Thomas. When Daniel and Patricia moved to Kensington, California, near Berkeley in 1978, they bought a Steinway grand piano. Edie Bell, who is joining us live via call-in, played many house concerts on the Ellsberg piano. That was a Steinway. When Dan got his fatal diagnosis in February 2023, Dan's son, Michael, he's going to join us in a moment, asked their family friend, Ms. Bell, to compose, record a tribute for Daniel. The result was North Star. An initial draft was played for Daniel on his deathbed in 2023, May, and he was deeply moved. Today, here on Flashpoints, we are premiering the final studio version of North Star, recorded with 80s ensemble Venus Exalted. This is also the debut of 80s music on a national level, on the National Radio Network. So, ultimately, this show today celebrates the life and times of Dan Ellsberg, that he loved music, and that he was given a lovely song to float away on, which today we're making available to the whole world. So, let's listen to North Star.
Exposing tyrants and
Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are premiering this song in honor of Daniel Ellsberg. It was written by his side as he lay dying. And it's a year since we've lost Dan, and we wanted to take this hour. We don't usually do this on Flashpoints, but we wanted to take this hour and honor Dan, who was a friend of this show and, of course, a friend of the world and a friend of peace around the world. And let's begin with the singer-songwriter. Joining us is Edie Bell. Welcome to Flashpoints, Edie. It's good to have you with us. Thank you for sharing that song now that it's done for the rest with the rest of the world.
Thank you so much for having me here tonight. I deeply appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate having you. Why don't you talk a little bit about the process. It's unusual. I believe this was written initially on Dan's grand piano as a part of a series of house concerts. Tell us about that.
Thank you. Yes, well, you know, Michael had called me up and gave me the
Dan's
news.
Dan's son, Michael.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dan's son, Michael, thank you. And shared the news about Dan's situation, and he said, Haiti Bell, I would love for you to write a piece in tribute to my father. And initially I was so shocked and kind of stunned and a little like starstruck, right? I felt overwhelmed and excited, but you know, how does one approach, you know, paying homage to such a deep and powerful, beautiful leader? And so it took me quite a while to, you know, find a really still, quiet place within myself to open up to what I would call sort of the energies of Dan Ellsberg's life. One of the most inspiring parts of deepening into my understanding of his work and his world came from the beautiful documentary that was created about him called The Most Dangerous Man in America, which tells the story of, you know, how he came to fall in love with this beautiful woman, Patricia. And I thought of, you know, the power of this love, the power of their union was so profound and so life-altering for him that it changed the path of what, you know, he was doing in his life and became the kind of, you know, peace activist that he became. So that was woven into the piece as I was, you know, right? So as I was feeling into the, what is the myth? What is the legend? Like, what is the transcendent theme that this man was, you know, living for us to be inspired by?
Yeah. Well, one of those myths, one of those parts of Daniel Ellsberg is, of course, he released a document that helped to end a war and change history. And a lot of people know a lot about that. But this piano thing, I think I'm a little shaken because I just finished reading a couple of essays about Dan and that piano that helped you compose this piece. And I'd like to bring Michael Ellsberg into this discussion now. Michael, welcome to Flashpoints. It's good to have you with us. Thank you and for bringing Mom and bringing this song to us. But there's a lot more to know about Dan's background when it comes to piano and music. And it started when he was about 5 years old. Could you tell us a little bit about this amazing backstory about Dan at five beginning to prepare to become a concert pianist?
Yes. Thank you so much, Dennis. Thank you so much, AD. I'm excited to be here with my mom next to me. And when Daniel was writing his memoir, Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam in the Pentagon Papers, he was writing it in the late 90s. It was published 2001. And there was some question as to whether it was going to be a full autobiography or more of a memoir of the Vietnam and Pentagon Papers experience. And for a variety of reasons, they chose the latter, which I think was the right choice for that book. But what that meant was there was hundreds of pages, actually, of outtakes that didn't get published, autobiographical outtakes. And one of those very powerful, moving piece is about 30 pages called The Piano, and it is actually going to be published along with some of those other outtakes probably next year by Bloomsbury. We're, as you mentioned, putting out a book of his posthumous writing. And that is a really gut-wrenching piece about his childhood. He was raised in a piano family, you know, to be a concert pianist, and it was very rough. You mentioned you were in a gymnastics family, so you probably know some of the terrain there of just, you know, constant discipline
pain,
and practice. And he didn't really question, this was just sort of his destiny. He was, you know, told that he was talented. His mom was incredibly passionate about it. He was raised, he actually got excused from elementary school half days so he could practice 6 hours a day. He practiced full days on weekends. And he got, you know, quite good. I was just listening. Apparently his kind of culmination of his playing was Beethoven's Third Concerto. At a recital, they had brought in the Detroit Symphony at a recital, and I just listened to that on YouTube, a contemporary performance, and man, that is a serious piece of piano playing there. And just imagining my dad playing that with a symphony. When he was 15, and then this is kind of the next essay in this series, July 4th, 1946, the family was driving on a family trip, and his father fell asleep at the wheel, and they got into a very bad accident, and unfortunately his mother and his sister died in that accident. His father survived, at that time he kind of reevaluated, after the grief, after the shock, he kind of reevaluated, you know, is this career really mine? And he, for a variety of reasons, kind of realized that he hadn't really chosen this career. It had kind of been chosen for him. And he came to question whether this really was his destiny. And, you know, we may have had a great concerto player had he continued with that destiny, but I wouldn't exist, and the Pentagon Papers wouldn't exist. So I'm glad he chose a different destiny.
And it's important to point out that his mom was focused like a laser on Dan becoming a concert pianist from age 5. And this, you learn what a struggle it was for Dan. I mean, imagine, he points out to people that he did not steal the Pentagon Papers, but he did pilfer a series of copies of collections of Reader's Digest articles that he sort of smuggled out of, I guess, the school where he was taking some piano lessons. And he had to sneak and read them under the covers because Mom was focused on one thing and one thing alone, and that was him becoming a concert pianist. And in a way, it made sort of, I mean, imagine this kid stealing Reader's Digest and hiding them.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine because he was, you know, the ultimate reader. I mean, we're dealing with his library now, and it's just, you know, endless, probably thousands and thousands of volumes. But he wasn't really allowed to read as a boy, and he was passionate even then about reading. But that was a distraction from the playing. As he recounts in this essay, which is really gut-wrenching, it was a very mixed experience at best. This was not a happy experience for him. To a very large degree, his mother's love was kind of dependent on how much he was practicing and how well he was doing. And if he ever tried to stop, or I think one time he said he wanted to quit, and, you know, he instantly got the silent treatment. So this was...
She wouldn't talk to him.
Yeah. So this was not a, you know, a happy period in his life, which is, I think, why he... didn't really continue his playing after that. Is that it wasn't exactly a happy memory for him. He was very much a music lover, and he loved jazz. He loved Chet Baker. He turned me on to Chet Baker when I got into 80s music, 80 Bell, not the decade 80s. I brought her in, and we did multiple house concerts on Dan Steinway in our living room, and he really appreciated 80s playing quite a bit. And it was nice to be able to continue Dan's musical heritage here, in that after he passed, we decided to gift this 1978 Steinway Beautiful Baby Grand to 80, because she was really the one who made it sing. I took kind of dinky piano lessons as a kid, and Dan played here and there, but he never quite had that passion for it after his mom died, and it was beautiful to be able to...
I guess he sort of felt guilty, right? And maybe he felt troubled that he was betraying her even in death. That he was turning his back in a way on music. Did he struggle with that? Maybe I should ask, let's bring Mom into this. Welcome, Patricia Ellsberg. It's really good to have you. I don't think you ever have been on, yikes, on Flashpoints. I'm knocking stuff around here. I'm very nervous. It's funny, I've been doing radio for 40 years, but this show and bringing, sort of summoning Dan with the music and his spirit a year later is really, and then reading about his struggle in terms of 5 to 15 being chained, essentially, with invisible chains holding him down to that piano. But tell us about Dan. And did he talk about this struggle? Did he feel guilty, for instance, that his mom was killed and, you know, he betrayed her even in death by not playing?
I asked him how he felt about his mother because it sounded to me something like childhood.
We're not hearing you. Is your mic, engineer, please turn on the mic.
Can you hear now? Dennis?
Yeah, I can hear you, but I don't know. Mike, can we figure this out?
Okay, here, come talk on this one. Yeah.
We'll play musical chairs.
Okay.
There we go.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no problem. I first of all, I'm so moved hearing the full version, 80, of this song. I've heard it in less magnificent versions and not on such a good sound system. So I'm just so touched. And I can understand, Dennis, why you're feeling a little something unusual in having heard the music and in this context. And it's genuinely, it brings tears to my eyes because we loved each other so much and I love you. And to have that kind of... romantic and accurate, but a romantic portrayal of the two of us, because he was my North Star, and you're saying I was his North Star, and I think there's some truth to that too. So I'm very touched and moved. And
I love you, Patricia.
Yeah, it's a mutual love affair, but anyway, I don't think he felt predominantly guilt. Dennis, I think he felt, you know, liberation. And maybe feeling a little guilty about that, but mostly free. I mean, he soon went to Harvard, and he loved it, and he was an intellectual and, you know, editor of the Crimson, and found his own nature being nourished, the whole part of him. And he really never was meant to be a pianist. I mean, it's kind of pathetic to think of that child being forced. I mean, he was normally gifted, you know, but nothing extraordinary. But he did say, yes, I love my mother. And I think they had a real closeness and a bond. And I think that the accident where his mother and sister was sitting on the right side of the automobile, and that the car was severed, and she and his sister Gloria were killed, and the father and Dan were okay. They were not hurt. Dan was in the hospital with a broken leg, but recovered, you know, had to heal for maybe 2 weeks in the hospital, but basically was alive and well. And so I think that he probably was inflicted with a kind of survivor mentality to some degree. That's a common affliction or state of mind when somebody lives through something and other people have died. And I think that he felt he owed a life to the world. And that allowed him to take such big risks with his life, both in Vietnam when he went there to kind of understand the war and went out with troops, but more so, more directly, when he was willing to face a life in prison to stop accidents and killing of civilians and stop wars. And I think that I'm complete for that answer.
Well, could you, by the way, did he play in the house a lot? You had the Steinway there. Did he?
He did.
Avail himself?
He availed himself, but it never felt like, oh, I'm loving this. You know, he'd kind of go over the same piece and end at the same place.
He was still 10 years old practicing for
right.
Mom.
That's exactly right. I don't think he was that good a sight reader. And so he didn't have that pleasure. It wasn't, you know, it was more or less a feeling of something to do with fraughtness. And I may be projecting, but there wasn't this melodious music that made one's heart sing. I would be cooking in the dining room, and there was kind of pretty much the sound would go from the kitchen to the living room where the piano was to the kitchen, and I'd be hearing the same piece with the same ending, you know, same and then he'd stop, you know, in the middle of the passage where he didn't know more. So I never got the feeling that it was a true love of his, whereas reading and thinking and you know, getting arrested and all of those things had a very different energy to it.
One has to wonder, I mean, does he remember, because he took that first teacher that Mom set him up with was rather brutal.
Miss Monobach. Miss Monobach, hideous.
He took a couple of serious, you know, this was like almost a daily beating,
right.
That he would get, or a weekly beating when he went to study with her. So he, I mean, he certainly learned how to transcend pain and suffering as a part of taking piano lessons.
Yeah, that's an unusual lesson. But we gave Michael piano lessons, and he really didn't take to them, and we didn't insist. But I have a vision, something so sweet, Michael. I don't know if you remember, but there was a big couch in the living room, not that far from the piano. And Dan would play, and my memory is that when you were little, you would kind of jump over the couch, and yes, he's nodding, yes, you know, and slide over the couch, and there was such an enchanted feeling with Dan playing Rachmaninoff or Chopin, and Michael jumping over the couch and landing on the floor and running over to, and jumping again. So, Michael never took to the piano, and of all people, Dan would not force him, and I had no, you know, any feeling.
Dan had a good reason.
Good reason. So neither of us.
He learned his lessons.
We weren't terribly disappointed, truthfully.
Yeah. Let me say, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and I'm delighted to be honoring and remembering Dan Ellsberg with the premier song, North Star, that we just played for you. And you've been just listening to Patricia Ellsberg, who spent many years with Dan. Patricia, would you tell us some other things about Dan that might surprise us or won't surprise us, make us happy?
Probably there are many things.
I have a couple of questions I'm hesitant to ask you. I might.
Well, I can always say I don't think I can answer that. But,
I don't have information on that right now.
One is that I bet many people don't know that he was a really quite good magician. And he would give magic
yes.
shows at birthday parties for his friends' children. And they were a big hit. There's actually a scene of that in The Most Dangerous Man in America, the film. They filmed him doing that. But he was really quite skillful, and I believe he learned some of the tricks, or many of them, in jail when he would get arrested. He was arrested about over 90 times for civil disobedience, objecting to war, one war or another.
By the dozen, the baker's dozen.
Exactly. And so he perfected some of those skills and then would entertain the fellow jailmates. He'd smuggle in a deck of cards, so that, but he really got pleasure from giving the shows, and the kids.
Well,
delight.
Folks in jail would love it because it's the magic, if you're good, is the perfect scam.
Exactly. And even sometimes when we were walking along, there'd be a little kid and two parents, the kid would be slightly ahead, and he would take a quarter out of his pocket and then say, wait a minute, to the kid, and then touch the kid's ear, and the quarter would look like it came out of the ear, and he would give it to the child. And he took great delight in that. And there was a very playful side to Dan that most people didn't see. And I'm not saying it was the predominant one, but it was definitely there, not just playing the piano, but, telling jokes that weren't very good and all sorts of delights. Food.
Certainly a magician with abracadabra and abracadabra. We're going to end the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Quickly.
Yeah.
By the way, we just happen to have a friend of yours here who Dan did some of those magic tricks for. I think Anita is on the line joining us,
yes,
I hope.
I am.
Welcome, Anita Barrows.
Hi, Dennis. Hi, Patricia and Michael.
Hi.
As you were talking about Dan's magic tricks, Patricia, I was remembering a couple of birthdays. I met you and Dan when my kids were quite young. And Viva was about 6 years old, I think. And there were a couple of birthday parties of Viva where Dan came and did his magic. And it was wonderful. It was a total delight to all the kids. And last year, my grandson, Nora's son, Dashiell, shares a birthday with Dan. And I'm sure you remember, Patricia, last year on Dan and Dashiell's joint birthday, we brought over a very gloppy chocolate cake. It was a classic chocolate birthday cake with candles and happy birthday, Dan and Dashiell, the whole nine yards. And Dashiell was delighted. Dashiell and Dan were exactly 85 years apart. And Dashiell was delighted to have Dan do magic tricks for him. And there was Dan 2 months from his death, actually, and still sitting in the kitchen telling funny jokes. We told a whole bunch of jokes that afternoon, and he did some beautiful magic tricks for Dashiell.
What do you, Anita, remember best? What about you? What about Dan changed, if you will, the way you are, I think? What did you learn from Dan?
Yes, well, when 80s song got to that place that was repeated a number of times, the sort of refrain, truth teller, soothsayer, dragon slayer, that really was, those were really the things that I deeply, deeply admired about Dan. And not only admired, I felt like I needed to learn the courage that he had. I was so awed by the courage of somebody who would potentially give up his life and spend the rest of his life in prison in order to tell the truth. And I thought, okay, this is the model. And I have to say that for my daughter, Nora, who was maybe 11 or 12 when she met Dan, those qualities of his that I so deeply admired were really, really important to Nora. She saw those qualities in him right away, even without knowing much about his story. I told her little bits, and then, of course, when she got to high school and read Howard Zinn's history, she realized who this family friend of ours was, and it it was very, very important to Nora and to my younger daughter, Viva, to have Dan as the example of somebody who would risk everything in order to do the right thing.
And Michael, do you want to talk a little bit about why it's important to celebrate and remember Dan, and why it's important to do it both with words and music? Why this is important to you?
Yeah. You know, he talked about very dark things most of the time. In fact, that's most of my memories is hearing him talk. I call myself a joyful pessimist. I got the pessimism from my father and the joy, fortunately, also from my mother, and I try to integrate them. So he talked about, you know, very challenging things, all the things. I think he would have just been utterly devastated by what's going on in the world now with Ukraine and Gaza and Taiwan, and so there was always this very dark sensibility. Yet on the other side of that, he was very much guided by the sense of the power of truth telling and the power of speaking out, even if it seems like there's no hope. AD's song, you know, captures that, of the line, you know, sometimes it feels like nothing will ever change. And that's certainly a feeling that he had, and that I think many of us listening have. And yet somehow finding that there's still something, you know, how can you keep going forward even when you see no hope? What is guiding you? What is your North Star that's orienting you even when you just can't see any way out? And somehow he managed to keep going, even though he honestly didn't have a lot of hope. That was something he maybe, you asked, you know, things that might surprise people. He was always a little cautious to say this kind of thing, but he didn't feel a lot of hope around the world. He felt, I would say, hopeless would be a fair word of how he felt a lot. And yet somehow he didn't give up. He just kept going with this thought, well, maybe this could still do something. And I think that's something I really learned from him, is how not to depend on hope, how to keep going in what you believe in, even when you don't see hope or don't feel it.
Wow. Well, Patricia, what was it like to be with Mr. Pentagon Papers? How did that affect your relationship? I guess it had some impact.
It had some impact. That was our first year of marriage.
I'm working my understatement.
But I fell in love with him so much before the release of the Pentagon Papers, because he was so brilliant and attractive and sexy, I have to say, and everything dashing, and more deeply, I really sensed his integrity. And even though we had different opinions of the war for quite a bit of pre-marriage, where I was more against it sooner and than he was, but we'd discuss it, and I was always impressed by his thoughtfulness and his criticism as well of U.S. stances and who we chose to be the puppet governments in Vietnam, as well as his deeply ingrained concern about the spread of communism at that time. So I respected him, and I fell in love with him. But we did break up over the war. I went to see him in Vietnam, and at one point we went to a party that was a farewell party for Neil Sheehan, and who was the reporter that received the Pentagon Papers from Dan and helped
the
get
New York
them printed
Times. Yeah.
In the New York Times. And there was a man from Canada who had been in the North. Americans weren't allowed to go to the North at that time. And he was telling us about how we were bombing hospitals in the North and schools. And it was at this party. And I just turned to Dan and And I said, how can you be part of this? Which I was feeling too, because I was there and we were supposed to go on a vacation, and it didn't turn out he could leave. So I fashioned this purpose of staying in Vietnam with him, with a reporter, Frankie Fitzgerald, and I helped her do research on an article of how were we treating the Vietnamese that were escaping from our bombing and coming to Saigon. And so I would do research in the day, and I'd be walking where these poor refugees from our bombing had little shacks that they'd find wood to make, and so I'd come back furious. So somehow all of that built up, and it ended our relationship for 3 years. I left, and I didn't hear from him because he was insulted by my saying, how can you be part of this? And but I still kept looking for Mr. Wright, didn't find him. And Dan came back from the Vietnam and called me when he was passing through New York. And, you know, I kind of had a date that night, so he came over in the afternoon, and I was delighted to say, I'm sorry you have to go, because I was mad at him, you know, for kind of dropping me. And anyway, he worked his way back into my heart quite quickly. And, of course, he had changed so much, so there was no barrier whatsoever. And so wow. When I married him, I knew, in our first year of marriage, I knew he had copied the papers, but he was only going to give them to the senators, and that would have been pretty safe. And both Senator Fulbright, who was head of the Foreign Relations Committee, and George McGovern, who was about to run for president, were very excited to receive some copies of some of the Pentagon Papers, not all 7,000 pages. And so his hopes were up, and neither of them did anything that they were talking about doing, of hearings or raising it, you know, with, you know, protesting from the facts that we'd been lied into this murderous war. So there they were, this copy sitting in the house. And I said to him, Dan, what makes you think these are so important? He had protected me from reading them. He didn't want my fingerprints in the one copy that we had. And so I said, what makes you think these are so important if Fulbright and McGovern aren't doing anything with them? And he said, well, I'm going to select some key passages, and you read them, and then we can talk. And so we had a one-room apartment with a large closet that was our bedroom. So I went into our bedroom, and he worked at home. So it was a very crowded little apartment. He was at MIT at the time. And I read these selected passages, and I just came out crying, Dennis. And I said to him something he hadn't perceived. I said, this is the language of torturers. They were using phrases like one more turn of the screw or the water drop technique in the passages I was reading with their bombing. And I just said, these have to come out. And I really didn't feel they were that dangerous to put out, because it was history and it was Democrats, and Nixon was in office, a Republican, and there were no troop movements, nothing to do with the battle, you know, but more the political aspects of our presence there. And I couldn't have been more wrong. But in any event, he only had one copy, so... So I could have well been indicted, and I came from a very Republican family, and my dad knew lots of generals by a fluke. I won't go into the story, but they ended up, my half-brothers, my mother died and dad remarried, had five more boys, and the godfathers of these boys were President Eisenhower, Omar Bradley, five-star general of World War II, same with George C. Marshall, dropped the bomb O'Donnell. These were Dad's friends, and he admired the military. And so when I fell in love with Dan, he still hadn't copied the papers, and Dad approved because he was at Rand Corporation, and we got married, and Dad did say, very perceptively, he's a troublemaker. Watch out. But I don't know why he said that, because Dad was, you know, a lieutenant general in the civil service, and was going to Vietnam. Anyway, when the Pentagon Papers came out, my father was not pleased. And I went to lunch with him after the trial. He said, that bum should have gone to jail. And I said, Dad, let's not talk about my husband.
Yeah. Let me say, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we have to, the FCC tells us we have to be careful about those four-letter words, even though they're the best part of the language. But speaking of poetry and the best part of our language, I met Dan with Allen Ginsberg at Rocky Flats in Colorado.
Fabulous.
Where they were together getting arrested protesting the nuclear triggers that were being created for the hydrogen bombs, the big ones. It was my first documentary. It was my first news interview ever. It was Dan Ellsberg, Dan Allen Ginsberg. And so I asked Dan, I was like very, very serious. And what can we do to stop nuclear weapons and nuclear war? And Dan gave me a great answer. And then I asked Allen, what are you going to do? Allen Ginsberg, what are you going to do? They're standing there together, two extraordinary representations of humanity, right?
Right.
And Allen says, I said, Allen, are you going to resist? And he says, no, I'm not going to resist anything. I am here to make love to plutonium. And Dan almost fell on the floor laughing. But that brings me to another question. Was Dan in any way interested? He had such an extraordinary mind. One would think on the one hand he wouldn't want to mess with it, but on the other hand, was he interested in psychedelics or in...
I guess since he's passed, I can.
No, he was open about it.
He was quite open, yeah. But they weren't legal. But in any event, yes, he was a great fan.
Did you ever trip with him?
Oh, of course. Dennis, what do you think? Absolutely. But, you know, one is, I just want to say how much I adored him, and he adored me. I mean, we really were partners, and he said of all the people that he got advice from, which was numerous, you know, that he really listened to my advice most of all. And I was wise, you know, and for things, but not for crazy things. Anyway, oh my gosh, the ecstasy of that was quite extraordinary. And maybe three or four times a year we would do it very, very parsimoniously, but it, you know, birthday or Christmas or something like that. Yes. And it had a very good effect on him, because he opened to the magnificence of nature. When you're on a trip like that, you see everything is alive and almost feels sentient. And yes, he loved it, and he was expanded by it in very deep ways.
Wow.
And since we're here, and I have Mom next to me, and I think I can say that my mom and father guided me on my first acid trip when I was 20, so 27 years ago. And it was beautiful. We ended up in a puddle of tears. I was just sobbing with my love for them. And, you know, a 20-year-old boy like isn't usually like overwhelmingly sobbing about his love for his parents, but something about the that medicine opened it up in me, and it was really the first time I got in touch with, you know, that depth of how much I cared about them.
Amazing. Free for all, anybody jump in? What do you want to say? We got a few minutes left.
Well, I
want to say how... Oh, go
ahead, Anita, please. Yeah. Please, and then I'll say it.
All right. I just wanted to say how much I have missed being able to talk to Dan this last year about the things that are going on in the world. I mean, particularly what's happening in Gaza. Patricia and I have dinner once a week. We have really deepened our friendship in this past year, which is a great gift. And we certainly talk about what's happening in the world and deeply and we very often come back to, wow, you know, what would Dan say to this? And we know that he would have been absolutely appalled at what's going on and heartbroken. But I sometimes I try to imagine what he would say and what he would tell
us. What Dan would say, yes.
Yeah.
Sometimes, Dennis, this is Patricia,
yes.
I feel it was blessed that he died when he did, and Ukraine was going on, and when we first, I was there in a lot of the doctor appointments, and the first terminal diagnosis of pancreatic cancer said you have about anywhere from 3 to 6 months to live. Mm-hmm. He lived about 4 of those, and at least two of them were totally fine, you know, with not pain and things. And then he got a lot of pain medicine and got loopy. But what he said, just after hearing that, and we hung up the phone, and there were two things he said. The first thing he said was, I'm relieved. He said, I don't want to be around if what I fear might happen, meaning Ukraine and use of nuclear weapons, does happen. He said, I don't want to be around for that. And then he said, I want to call my heart doctor. And since this diagnosis is terminal, I think maybe, because he'd had a heart condition, mild congestive heart failure, he was off salt for 5 years.
And yes, cakes. I heard about that.
And he said,
what was it like when he tasted salt?
Oh my God, it was ecstasy. So we called the doctor, and the doctor said, indulge, yes, go ahead. And he said, can I really indulge? And the doctor said, indulge away. And the next thing he said was, would you go out and get some lox and bagels? And so about every couple of days I had to go and renew. Oh, it was heaven. And I think, Dennis, that he was amazingly cheerful those four months. No pain. Hospice was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, I love hospice. Yes.
Oh, my God. And Jill, the head nurse. I could only get him to take medicines. He said, I don't want any more medicines, you know, for pain. And I said, Jill wants you to take the medicine. And his mouth would open a little bit, and I'd squish the little syringe in, you know, whoosh, in and get the medicine in. But he was at peace with himself, which is what I so am glad with, because... You know, he didn't feel he left much legacy because the war was going on, the bombs are still there, but he felt he'd done everything he could, which was absolutely true, and therefore he was at peace with leaving the world before the worst things happened.
And he made it a joyful act of he sort of flipped the cliche, rubbing salt on the wound.
Exactly.
It was
exactly.
A healer.
Exactly. Yes.
He was ecstatic.
You know,
go ahead, Anita.
There's a little sort of soundbite that KPFA plays every now and then. They, you know, have a bunch of these little things. And the one from Dan is... to some degree uncharacteristic of him, because he's speaking very optimistically. He says, nobody ever would have thought that the Berlin Wall would fall, but it fell. Nobody ever would have thought that apartheid would end in South Africa, but it did. And nobody ever would have thought that Nixon, who won the election by a landslide a couple years later, would leave office. But that happened. And he said, we have to be able to imagine what seems impossible. And I really hold that in my heart. I mean, I know that you're the one, Patricia, who has carried the joy and the optimism for the family. But Dan had a little bit of that from time to time. And it's so heartening to remind ourselves that it's true. There are lots of things that we have thought would be impossible, and yet they've happened.
Yes.
And so why not imagine?
Yes. Listen, I'm sorry to interrupt. We are smack against the clock. So before we say goodbye, I want to say thank you to all of you. Michael, thank you for helping us make this happen. Adi, incredible music. How can people learn more about your music? Is there a website that people can follow you on?
There is. Thank you. My website is Oracle88. So that's the word Oracle and the number 88.com. And I'm so grateful for the love of the Ellsberg family to be included in this conversation, for this opportunity to connect with you all in celebration of Dan.
Thank you. And we have been trying to do something on Palestine and the genocide every show. This is the first show. We just made room for Dan. But Anita, you're writing a poem every day. Can you do it in a minute?
I can.
Go for it. Anita has been writing a poem every day of the war, every day of the genocide.
Every
day. Please. 40 seconds,
go. 252. What she remembers best from that night was her niece's long blonde hair, Mariam, 8 years old. She had been put to bed by her mother and was sleeping beside her little brother. I do not know how to go on telling this story. The woman who told it, Reem, was the one survivor. They had eaten, talked, read, gone to bed. The zone they were in was supposed to be safe. Reem awakened to find the ceiling collapsed on top of her. How did she breathe? How did she dig her way out, rock by rock in the dark, slab by slab? With what strength she stood, walked, and then saw Mariam, with whom she'd been playing only hours before. Mariam's long blonde hair, straight, halfway down her back, still brushed, shining the way her mother brushed it every night before bed, tied it so it wouldn't tangle. The tie still there, Mariam dead on the ruined floor of the house, blood streaming from her mouth, but her hair perfect,